another road that comes down this way. So one of those two roads he uses to come down here, they collect Jesus at Gethsemane, and they take him back to the house of Annas first. And we learn that in the other Gospels, not in Matthew. But Annas' house is going to be over in this area. And then they go to Caiaphas. And from there, they convict Jesus. And Jesus is then going to have another trial very early in the morning, probably about 5:30 or so in the morning. And that's most likely going to take place in the place where the Sanhedrin would normally meet, and that would be over here in the temple. So they've gone from over here to the Garden of Gethsemane and back, and they bounce around here a little bit during the night, and then they're going to end up over here. Then he's probably going to end up before Pilate at the Antonia Fortress. There's some traditions that would state that he's going to be over here at Herod's palace, but that's probably less likely because of what John says about why the Jews won't go in to the fortress. The Jews didn't want to go in because they didn't want to make themselves unclean before the Passover. And there's no reason they wouldn't be able to go into Herod's palace for fear of being unclean. But the Roman fortress would have been a place where executions would have taken place, where dead bodies would likely have been. And so the Jews wouldn't have wanted to be around the dead bodies before the Passover. And so at that point, he's going to be here, and he's going to be sent to Herod early in the morning. And Herod doesn't know what to do with him, so he sends him back to Pilate. And then he's back over here, and this is where he's going to end up being convicted eventually. And there's a traditional site over here for where the crucifixion would have taken place. There's another spot up here that is also a possible location. And so he's going to have to carry the cross from here either to out here or to out here. Both of those would have been outside the city gates in public places. And that's going to be in correlation with Scripture, but also in correlation with Roman tradition and Roman law that executions had to happen in prominent places. Yeah, Trey?
What's the scale on the map?
The scale on the map. If you can see this right here, that is a quarter mile. And so that will actually come into play a little bit later, is that wherever he's crucified here from the temple, which is where the Passover celebration is going to be taking place while he's going through the crucifixion, he's less than a half mile away at this time. He's less than a half mile away. So Jesus is bouncing all over the city, and he's doing a lot of this very quickly. We talked about he's arrested that night after dark, so probably 9 or 10 o'clock. They try him, they convict him, they try him again real quick and dirty at 5:30, and he's going to be on the cross by 9 o'clock the next morning. So things do happen very quickly here. Let's pick up where we left off last week in Matthew chapter 27, and we'll read verses 15 through 23. So Matthew 27, beginning verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. And they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said, "Let him be crucified." And he said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." Interesting thing about Barabbas. Barabbas' name actually means son of the father. It's interesting that that is the name of the man who's going to be released. But Barabbas he's well known to the people. He's a robber. He's an insurrectionist. We read about him in all four of the gospel accounts. We read about him. And this is a man that they knew about. It was a man that no one really had much love for. And the Jews are going to choose this very unrighteous man over Jesus. They're going to choose him. And this isn't really something that they're making. Remember, this is very early in the morning. Most of the people who are probably here are against Jesus before they've heard anything. They're there because they want to see Jesus executed. And the chief priests and the elders are kind of working the crowd up here, making sure that that's what's going to happen. And then Pilate's wife, we see, warns him of a dream. One of the interesting things I ran across is that the Coptic Christian and the Catholic traditions actually teach that this woman had a name, and her name was Procula. And Procula ends up converting to Christianity and these traditions. Now, whether that's one of those wishful thinking kind of things or whether that's true or not, it is interesting. And we don't know if this dream was from God or not, or if this dream was just a normal dream. Certainly we see God in the Old Testament talking to people through dreams, so it's not out of the question that God would have sent Pilate's wife a dream. And then I think Pilate here, he utters one of the more profound things, one of the more profound questions we'll see in all of Scripture. What then shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ? You know, we have that song, What Will I Do with Jesus? And I think it's an interesting question that he asks. What am I going to do about Jesus? It's a question we all have to answer. It's a question everyone in the world today has to answer. To a lot of people, that answer is simple. Nothing. But what's our answer going to be? What are we going to do with Jesus? What are we going to do with this man who is called the Christ? But Pilate seems convinced he's innocent, but the Jews absolutely want him to be crucified. They're not backing down on this. They're not going to back down on this. So let's continue here in verse 24. We'll just read through 26. So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves. And all the people answered, His blood be on us and on our children. Then he released for them Barabbas, and having Jesus scourged, delivered him to be crucified. We kind of talked about this a little bit last week, but Pilate's primary role is to make sure Rome doesn't have to worry about Judea. That's his primary role, is to make sure rebellions don't start and the cash keeps coming back. That's his job. And he's about to lose control of the city during Passover. And during Passover, the population of the city is going to swell to many times what it normally was. So this is the worst possible time for Pilate to lose control. It's the most visible time. He's there in Jerusalem from his capital where he normally is in Tiberias, just to make sure that everything is going to be okay. Excuse me, not Tiberias, it was Caesarea. But he's there to make sure, and he's about to lose control. And so you can imagine his dilemma here, right? He doesn't see anything wrong, but the Romans don't value their subjects' lives like we would value our citizens' lives today. And so he makes that decision there. And he washes his hands of Jesus. This is very ceremonial, right? It doesn't mean anything. Another interesting thing we see here is that the Jews took on Jesus' blood on themselves and on their children. It's an interesting way that they say it too, isn't it? His blood be on us and our children. So what does the Old Testament tell us about the sins of the father? They don't go to the children. The sins of the soul who sins, that soul shall die. That's what we read in Deuteronomy chapter 24. However, in Exodus chapter 34, God visits the iniquity of the father on future generations. And so I think there's some correlation here that are there consequences when we sin and when we allow sin into the world? Yeah, there's consequences. And those consequences follow our children sometimes. Regrettably, they do. But does the guilt follow our children? No, the guilt doesn't follow our children. It's interesting that for a lot of years, Christians used this verse to discriminate against people who were still worshiping as Jews. They would blame the Jews for Jesus dying. I think that's an interesting interpretation because it's pretty clear to me, especially in the writings of Paul, that I'm the one who's responsible for Jesus being crucified, and that you're the one responsible for Jesus being crucified. And regardless of who actually drove the nails in his hand and worked up the crowd that day, it's my fault, and it's your fault. And every time we fail, it's our fault again, and that's our constant struggle with ourselves, is to try to live lives worthy of that sacrifice. And it certainly is a very difficult thing. But I do think it's interesting the words that they use. His blood be on us and our children. Does anybody here want Jesus' blood to cover their children? I do. Absolutely I do. I want Jesus' blood to wash them. And this is something that especially the Hebrew writer is going to use over and over again to talk about the blood. The blood. The blood. The blood. It's so important. And we see this In the book of Revelation as well, in chapter 7, we see this multitude that have washed their robes white in the blood of the Lamb. So I think it is interesting that even though the Jews are basically saying, we'll take responsibility for his death, they say it in a way that we would all probably want to say that today, which is Jesus' blood, we want it to cover us. We want it to wash us. So we see in verse 25, Barabbas is going to be released, and that Jesus was scourged. Now, a scourging here, this is just one word, right? And we can read by this very quickly. But I don't want us to go by it too quickly. The brutality of this one word really can't be expressed. And I'll put this up here. I thought about showing this in class, but I hesitate because it's so violent. I don't know how many of you back in, was it 2003 that the Passion of the Christ movie came out that Mel Gibson produced? And there's some things in that movie that maybe he took some artistic license with, certainly even in this scene. But if you have your smartphone or a pencil and want to write this down, this is a link to the scene where Jesus was scourged. And I would encourage each one of you, as we've studied this whole quarter about Jesus, I hope you've been feeling closer and closer to him and learning more and more about him. I would challenge you to try to make it through this video, to make it through watching the Son of God get beat. And it's an actor, it's a dramatization, but it's going to be very close in the tone of what the Romans are going to do to him. So the brutality here of the scourging is a deterrent for the Romans, just like crucifixion is a deterrent for the Romans. Many of the prisoners, they're going to die just from the scourging alone. The scourging would start off with some elements, but usually it would end up with some of the sources will call it a scorpion. And it essentially is a whip with many tails, and the tails have embedded pieces of bone and metal and rock and things like that in them. And so that what you would do is you would whip the flesh, and then you would actually rip the flesh apart as you pulled back. And you begin to open the back up with each one. Historical sources talk about they would actually, the Romans were conscientious about things like this. They wanted to have a nice even beating. So they would have a man on each side, and you would beat the guy on here with his right side, and then on the other side over here, you would get on his left side. And part of the reason they want to do that is they want to inflict maximum pain without causing death. And some people did die from the scourgings. They would expose the skeletal structure. They would expose organs. People would die of blood loss. It's very likely that Jesus slipped in and out of consciousness during this. There's one part in this scene in the Passion of the Christ that I thought was really interesting. Jesus is being beat. He's essentially fallen down. He's about to fall on the ground. And at that point, one of the female characters walks in. I believe it's his mother. And he sees her. And he locks eyes with her. And he keeps looking at her, and he stands back up. And that's artistic license, right? But I can imagine Jesus there being beaten, literally to the end of his life. And what's he thinking about at that moment? Why does he get back up and take it? Because he's told us a chapter before, he doesn't have to go through this. He submitted to God's will, but he's told his apostles, knock it off with that sword, Peter. I've got the angels at my disposal. Jesus gets back up. Jesus sits there and takes this abuse and takes this beating for us. So while the movie shows him looking at his mother, in many ways, he's picturing us, his bride, God's children, his own family. The Jews had some laws about how many times you could actually whip somebody as well. If you recall, the Old Testament would only let you be whipped 40 times. And so the Jews wanted to be very careful. They don't ever want to offend God. They had the tradition of 40 save one, just in case they miscounted. So they would only whip 39. The Romans, according to some of the commentaries, to show that disrespect to the Jews would go past that, maybe even to 41 or maybe much past that. But the Jews are definitely going to want to get past that. So you can imagine here a lot of what Jesus is going to be going through. All right, let's continue on here in verse 27 through 31. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him, and they took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of his robe and put him in his own clothes, or his own clothes on him, and led him away to crucify him. So some of the times we're going to see this again in movies or in pictures, this is kind of a small crowd again. But remember, he's back in the Antonia Fortress. He's there amongst everybody. So again, this, just like it was a pretty large group, probably several hundred soldiers that came out to get him, this again is going to be several hundred soldiers crowding around him, humiliating him, spitting on him, beating him. It kind of helps us to appreciate the scene a little bit more. And they give him this crown of thorns to mock him as the king. And they strike him on the head with that on there. So you can imagine the pain he's already going through. They're just adding more to it. And they put the robe on him. And that robe probably starts to stick to his blood that's starting to coagulate. And they rip it off. And you can imagine that would begin to cause those wounds to open back up. And they're doing it for no other reason other than to humiliate him and to torture him. So, you know, these Roman soldiers, they're rough customers, right? They're very rough customers, and necessarily so. They're a foreign power trying to oppress, by nature, a very rebellious people. And you can imagine that they don't like this Passover time. They're on edge. Everybody else is on edge. And they're taking all this out on Jesus at this point. So do we have any comments before we go on? I wanted to read a large chunk next. And just kind of let Scripture speak to us as we read the story of the crucifixion. So if you would read with me, we'll read 32 through 56. As they went out, they found a man from Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink, mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. And they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priest with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders hearing it said, "This man is calling Elijah." And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the other said, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him." Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." There were also many women there looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Joseph and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And so we talk about, we said this earlier, that by Roman law, crucifixion, so crucifixion is a deterrent, right? Just like scourging was a deterrent, but this is a public deterrent. This is something that they want to put up there. This kind of tradition continues for quite a while into even medieval culture. They called it gibbeting, right? They'd put somebody up in a place, like in a cage. You see this in movies sometimes, and they just left you there to die and starve. It was called gibbeting. And this is kind of like the Roman way of doing it. They'd leave the bodies up. Everybody's supposed to see the death. They're supposed to see the bodies. It's supposed to convince you that it's horrible to cross the Romans. And so this is going to be done in a public place. And sometimes we see these crosses and pictures, and they're up on a hill, and there's this lonely hill. I don't think that's the way it was, because that doesn't suit the Roman tradition, the Roman law. This was probably someplace. Jesus has already walked through the busy streets. The streets are starting to wake up for that morning as people flood into the city for the Passover celebration that's going to start. Jesus has walked through crowded streets, and then he's going to be out in this place where we have people passing by. And even the people passing by are hurling insults at him. He's getting no rest here. And then he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is from the 22nd Psalm. You know, Larry preached a sermon just a few weeks ago talking about why did he say these words. He said these words because of us. He's up there because of us. But I think he picks his words very carefully here. These are the first words of the 22nd Psalm. I believe Jesus wants us at this point and wants those people there to think about the 22nd Psalm. And so I've asked Daryl if he would read that psalm to us, actually in its entirety. You know, this is so important that Jesus is going to make this one of his last things that he's going to say. So I'd like us to stop and to listen to this psalm. We see a lot of things here that the psalmist writes that reflect the events of that day. One of the interesting things that I read as well is that in some of the Aramaic translations, the last verse there, verse 31, that he has done it, might very well be translated as finished. And so in a very real way, Jesus' last two statements are the first and last part of this psalm. Psalm 22 through 24 are very important to the Jewish people at this time. These are psalms that they would have been brought up saying and hearing in the synagogues from birth. You know, there's a lot of theological discussion about, did Jesus actually get forsaken by God on the cross? That's one of those things that makes our head spin, right? The nature of the Trinity, and how can God forsake himself? And Jesus is God completely. How can he be forsaken when he is God completely? And rather than get into that, I think it is important, though, for us to realize Jesus is still standing around a bunch of Jewish people. He's not standing. He's crucified amongst the Jewish people. He's hanging there with them. I think with some of his last breaths, he's crying out to them again. Look who I am. Look what I'm doing. It's been written down for 1,000 years, or for 700 years. Go back and read about me. I think he's still up there teaching. I think he's still up there trying to seek and save the lost. There's a lot of things he could have said, but he chose to use the first part of a psalm that would have been very familiar to them, and they would have probably read it in the synagogue in the original language. They would not have been reading it in Greek. And so maybe that would be why here that he's actually using the original language, because he's speaking to that Jewish audience that's there, using it in the terms that they will remember. So, a few other things here I did want to bring out. Jesus was crucified at 9 a.m. We see this in Mark. Matthew doesn't specify the time that he was crucified, but Mark says it's at the third hour. And the way the Romans are going to count time is they count time in watches. And that day watch is going to start at 6 a.m. And so at the third hour, that is going to be at 9 a.m. What's interesting about this time is that during this time in the temple, the temple period, they're going to have what's called the perpetual sacrifice. It's going to happen twice a day. Every day they do this one thing at two times. They're going to sacrifice a lamb at 9 a.m. and again at 3 p.m. When they do that sacrifice, they blow what's called a shofar. And a shofar is simply a ram's horn. And you can imagine it's an unpolished horn. They're not going to use that for when they sacrifice the Passover lamb. But it's interesting that at that time, we talked about, Trey, they're about a half mile from the temple. And these guys are really good at blowing this shofar, right? And it's the temple shofar, so it's probably a big one. And this is a special day, so they've probably got their first chair trumpeter over there. I can imagine that half mile away, as they're driving those nails in Jesus' hand, lifting him up, that trumpet blows in the background. Another interesting tidbit, the Talmud records what's called 18 benedictions, and the Talmud is one of the Jewish holy books. The 18 benedictions, according to Jewish tradition, were already in use by this time of temple worship, and they were to be said 3 times a day, and that would have been at the third hour, the sixth hour, and the ninth hour, which would have been 9 a.m., noon, and 3 p.m. And it's interesting that if that is true, some of those benedictions talk about the Messiah. And they talk about mercy, and they talk about salvation from God. And so if this is to be believed, at the exact moment that Jesus is being crucified, thousands of Jews are in the temple. Tens of thousands of Jews are there praying for the Messiah to come. And that's an interesting thing here that the Jewish audience probably here would have known about. And we also see another time here that Matthew is going to talk about, which is the sixth hour. That's going to be 12 p.m. And this is going to be the time that it gets dark. And this time again in the Passover ceremony is not without its importance. At this time, that is the official start of the Passover celebration. That's the official time of the Passover celebration. And then furthermore, we see that right after 3 p.m., Jesus dies. Now, we talked about the perpetual sacrifice. On this day, they scooted forward that perpetual sacrifice, which usually took place about 3 o'clock. They moved it forward to 2. They still did it, but they needed to be sacrificing the Passover lambs by 3. There would have been about 17,000 priests, according to some sources, ready to receive all the Jewish families so that they could sacrifice these Passover lambs for all the pilgrims that were coming here. And the Passover lamb traditionally is going to start at 3 p.m. And they put away that dirty old shofar, and they bring out silver trumpets for this. They have 3 silver trumpets, and they're going to be blowing them as loud as they can to announce the start of the slaying of the Passover lambs. And it's at this moment that we read that Jesus is crying out his last couple words. And so, you know, I think we'll lose that as Western observers here. What really happens is that Jesus, he comes in as the Passover lamb is being selected. He comes into the city on Lamb Selection Day. And he ends up crying his last few sentences as they're sacrificing the Passover lamb. Jesus is our Passover lamb. We read that in the New Testament. In a very real way, chronologically, this all happens to him at the same time as what was happening to the Passover lamb. And we also see the temple curtain is going to be ripped from the bottom, or the top to the bottom. The earth shakes itself in the very response. The creation itself seems to be responding to Jesus dying. And we also see that there's a response here of those men who didn't have a vested interest in Jesus dying. You know, the chief priests and the elders, best we know, they're still there making sure Jesus is going to die, even though they're missing the ceremonies at the temple. We don't read that they left. You know, they said, if God comes and takes him down, then we'll believe he's the Son of God. But apparently, darkness and earthquakes and the dead rising, that wasn't enough for them. But the Romans saw it, and they came to what they thought was an unmistakable conclusion. So why does the temple curtain rip? Why is it ripped? It's different, right? It's different than man could do it. Man would have to rip it from the bottom, but we see it from the top to the bottom. That's an important thing. But if you didn't hear Paul was saying there's a separation. The Jews were very procedural about space in the temple. There's the court of the Gentiles, and there's the court of the women. There's the court of the lepers. And the priest could go up here, but only so far. And then you have the place where only the high priest could go. He only goes in there once a year, right? So that's it's quite a waste of space in some ways, right? But in a way, that's where they pictured that God left. As I was studying this, I came across somebody who said something. I thought, I had never heard this before, never thought about it. You know, I've traditionally thought about that as the separation is gone, and that we can now approach God. But in a very real way, if the Jews thought that God was in the Holy of Holies, it's God coming out. God comes out to the people at that moment. In a way, God has allowed himself to be boxed up in the temple. The temple worship was important. He's boxed himself up in the Jewish system. But at this point, he's coming out. And he's going to come out to everybody. And we're going to see that very shortly here. In a way, it's God's escape. So we just have a couple more minutes here. Actually, we only have one more minute, so we won't try to go on any further. So next week, we will pick up here in verse 57. And I do want to try to finish through chapter 28. So if you do have time this week, go and read chapter 28. This is the most important thing that's ever happened in the history of creation, chapter 28. And next week, we're going to be blessed enough, hopefully, if God wills, we'd be back here, to read about it and study about it. So, thank you very much.